Good morning. We're going to get started now. Before we start with this morning's speaker, just wanted to remind everybody about the internal medicine update, which is April 8th, 9th, and 10th. It's over at the Marriott on Military Trail near the mall. And obviously, we welcome all the residents and medical students and the attendings from here. This morning, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Ralph Palumbo, who went to medical school at the Medical College of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and did his residency in New York at Winthrop Hospital and his fellowship in pulmonary and critical care. Dr. Palumbo is one of our pulmonologists and critical care specialists here, so many of you know him. And today he's going to talk about VTE in 2016. And I'm also supposed to say he supposedly is the best fisherman on staff.
Good morning, everyone. So today we're going to talk about venous thromboembolism in 2016. I think this is probably one of the most up-to-date grand rounds that you'll get. Everything that I'm going to be talking about was published just 1 month ago by the American College of Chest Physicians in the journal Chest. Every several years, the ACCP comes out with a big packet of guidelines for both prophylaxis and treatment of VTE. So this last one was just published in February of 2016. This is the 10th edition of these guidelines. The previous 9th edition was in 2012. They've changed the format a little bit. They used to put out all at the same time a huge book of anticoagulation, basically for everything from acute coronary syndrome, VTE treatment, VTE prophylaxis. They've decided in the interest of bringing more up-to-date information more frequently to break it down. So this 10th edition that was just published deals only with VTE treatment. And that's what I'm going to talk about. Hopefully everybody has a good sense of the importance of VTE prophylaxis, how to go about doing that, why we do that. If there's any questions, feel free to ask. But otherwise, just because this information is so new and because there actually is a number of changes from what I think, unfortunately, our current practice often is, that I really want to spend time on these new guidelines and VTE treatment. So just to jump right into it, feel free to ask questions along the way or wait till the end. But first, we're going to talk about choice of therapy. So what do we choose when we're treating VTE? So recommendation number one is in patients with a proximal DVT or pulmonary embolism, we recommend long-term 3-month anticoagulant therapy over no such therapy. So this is pretty straightforward. Basically, they're saying if you diagnose either a pulmonary embolism or a proximal DVT, which we'll get to a little bit later, they do break down the difference, for example, in lower extremity in the distal, smaller veins below the knee versus the proximal veins. So we're talking about treating a proximal vein DVT or pulmonary embolism. They're recommending you treat the patient versus not treating the patient. It's not recommended just to observe those findings, although interestingly, I'll talk later on about a few caveats to that. And they're recommending the treatment is 3 months. So just in this guideline, there are two different definitions they use in terms of length of therapy. When they say long-term therapy, they're talking about 3 months. Anything beyond that, for example, lifelong therapy, they just call extended therapy. So that's a little deviation from some of the previous guidelines where there would be recommendations to treat some instances for 3 months, others for 6 months. Now the recommendation is if you're treating one incident, I guess you could say, a VTE, the recommended duration is for 3 months, no longer than that, unless, again, you're going to talk about indefinite treatment. So we'll talk a little bit more about that, but just to kind of put it in perspective now, if you have someone just had surgery, develops a DVT, you treat for 3 months, not for 6 months like I see some people do, or some of the recommendations may have mentioned that option in the past. Now they're really focusing down, it's just 3 months of treatment. If you have someone who's now had their third incidence of VTE, then they're going to go on extended therapy treatment, which basically means you're planning indefinitely, no stop date, but that too, you're going to adjust as things go. If 2 years down the road, they come in with a massive GI bleed, then you're going to change your plans. But those are your options. If you're treating a one-time incident, it's 3 months. Anything longer than that, you're in extended indefinite therapy. So a couple of recommendations here. If we have a patient with DVT of the leg or PE and no history of cancer, as long-term or three-month anticoagulant therapy, we suggest dabigatran, rivaroxaban, apixaban, or edoxaban over vitamin K antagonist therapy. So this, too, I think is a big change from our current practice. One thing I'm going to highlight before I go into that is no cancer. So this, too, is a huge shift in these current guidelines, is the recommendations are completely different if you have a patient who has cancer or who does not have cancer. So those two are going to be treated very differently. So if you have someone with no cancer, they're recommending the novel oral anticoagulants as first-line therapy, not warfarin. So that, again, I think is a big change over what we're doing now. The evidence shows that there are advantages to warfarin, which I have on the bottom there. When they looked at all the studies of the NOACs versus warfarin, there definitely was a reduced incidence of bleeding complications on the NOACs over warfarin, and also convenience, no drug monitoring, quicker time to therapeutic window, decreased hospital stay. So now they're recommending NOACs as first-line therapy. If you have a patient with DVT or PE in the second bullet here, if you have a patient with DVT or PE and no cancer who you elect not to treat with NOACs for some reason, then we suggest vitamin K therapy over low molecular weight heparin. So sometimes people are choosing to treat long-term VTE, just continue low molecular weight heparin and enoxaparin injections for the 3 months. So that's not recommended. That's really, a third line option. So option number one, NOACs. Number two, warfarin. Number three would be longer term low molecular weight heparin. So again, that's an acute DVT or PE, no history of cancer. Very important, which to me, the main thing is this would influence my choice of NOACs, is it's suggested that you start intravenous unfractionated heparin before dabigatran and edoxaban, but not necessary for rivaroxaban or apixaban. Just, I put this up here for the attendings versus the residents, because I know the residents learn all the generic names and the attendings learn all the brand names. So for me, I had to look this up because I can't keep them all straight. So dabigatran is Pradaxa, rivaroxaban Xarelto, apixaban is Eliquis, and edoxaban is Cyvasa. So the first and the fourth, the reason they're in this order, and they actually mention this in the guidelines, is not because of preference by the guidelines. This is the order that they were approved by the FDA and the studies were done, so they have kept them in that order. But number one and number four are the ones, because of their mechanism of action and onset of action, they should not be started without first anticoagulating the patient with intravenous unfractionated heparin. These other two, rivaroxaban and apixaban, Xarelto and Eliquis, it's not even necessary to start either Lovenox or unfractionated heparin prior. You can just give a dose of the oral anticoagulant and your therapeutic and your treatment is initiated. So I think those are important points. All right. So we'll move on from here. This is patients with cancer. So those, that last slide was without cancer. Now with cancer, what's the recommendation? Patient with DVT of the leg or PE and cancer, what they term cancer-associated thrombosis, they suggest low molecular weight heparin over VKA therapy or any of the NOACs. So the recommendation based on these guidelines is if you have a patient with active cancer who develops DVT or PE, you treat them with low molecular weight heparin injections for 3 months. So no warfarin, no NOACs. They need injection therapy for 3 months if they have active cancer. So now moving on to extended therapy. So some patients require extended therapy. Extended therapy, again, means in the new guidelines, indefinite therapy. So if you have a patient now with their second episode of DVT or PE, or a patient who maybe has high risk because they have active cancer, or who is bedbound, multiple risk factors. So any of these patients that you say, you know, three months is not enough, now they need extended therapy. So the recommendation for extended therapy is basically not to change your therapy if you don't need to. So what they're referring to here is you don't put a patient, say, on Lovenox for 3 months because they have cancer and need therapy, and then after 3 months say, well, now I can't continue the enoxaparin, I need to change to warfarin or one of the NOACs. Whatever you start, you should continue unless there's some reason not to. If the patient can't afford the drug you've treated them with the first 3 months, that's fine. Or if they can't tolerate, say, if you treat them with enoxaparin injections for the first 3 months and they refuse to keep injecting, you can change. But otherwise, the recommendation is if you start them on a therapy and there's no of those other reasons to change, you should continue it. The evidence supports continuing that same therapy. So now we'll talk about duration of therapy. I mentioned a little bit of this, but just to break it down further, in patients with proximal DVT of the leg or PE provoked by surgery, we recommend treatment with anticoagulation for 3 months over treatment for a shorter period. So less than 3 months is never recommended. Also, over treatment of a longer period, 6, 12, 24 months, or extended therapy with no scheduled stop date. So if this is a first-time VTE, maybe even a second time, but had a clear provocation surgery, you treat for 3 months, no more, no less, and then they're completed their treatment. If you have patients who have DVT or PE provoked by a risk factor other than surgery, they recommend, again, treatment of 3 months over treatment for a shorter period and over treatment for a longer period of 6, 12, 24. So whether you have a surgical risk or a non-surgical risk, but a clear risk factor, it's still 3 months of treatment. And then you have to modify the longer-term therapy based on their risk of bleeding. So their recommendation is they suggest treatment with anticoagulation for 3 months over extended therapy if there is a low or moderate bleeding risk, and treatment for 3 months if there is a high risk of bleeding. So those are it's the same recommendation. There are just two grades of evidence that why they separate that. But again, basically, if you have a risk factor, it's 3 months of therapy regardless. The evidence points, depending on risk, a little stronger or not, but it's still 3 months. The risk outweighs the benefits regardless of that. So any questions on that? Basically, to summarize all that stuff, 3 months of therapy if you have a provoked, identifiable reason. That's a good question. And the data on the Lovenox is from a bunch of trials that they looked at in cancer patients and just found that it was superior to either vitamin K antagonist or any of the NOACs. So they recommend, regardless of what you're treating or for how long, that should be the drug of choice. I don't know if I got your question with that or.
Well, you're basically committing somebody sometimes to very long-term Lovenox.
That is true, and that's what the recommendation are. That's why they put some caveats that if the patient can't tolerate it or you need to switch, you can switch to one of the others. But based on the best evidence, the least risk and the most effective therapy is the long-term Lovenox.
Is there a second choice?
The second choice is there was nothing else that was superior to the other. So the warfarin and the other NOACs were equivalent in that population. You can choose either one. So finally, in this recommendations about the timing, if you have an isolated distal DVT of the leg provoked by surgery or a non-surgical transient risk factor, we suggest treatment with anticoagulation for 3 months over treatment for a shorter period, treatment with anticoagulation for 3 months over a longer period, and treatment with anticoagulation for 3 months over extended therapy. So again, they're recommending this. The difference on this slide is the distal. The other recommendations we talked about were proximal. So if you find a significant DVT below the knee, for example, but they have a risk factor that is still ongoing, it is recommended that you treat. I'm going to talk a little more about distal DVT later and when you might not treat. But they're recommending here, if you have an active risk factor and you diagnose that distal DVT, you should treat for 3 months. Not all patients will be treated, which is what I said I'll mention when we get to that specific guideline. But if you do make the decision to treat, it's 3 months of therapy. In patients with unprovoked DVT, so the others that we talked about so far were with an identifiable risk factor. If you have unprovoked DVT or PE, they recommend treatment with anticoagulation for at least 3 months over treatment for shorter duration and treatment with anticoagulation for 3 months over a longer time-limited period. So again, 3 months of therapy. And then at the bottom, I have consider risk-benefit of longer therapy if unprovoked. So there's not any clear guidelines based on the research we have available yet of how long do you treat someone who's had an unprovoked DVT or a second episode of DVT. As of now, the thinking is those are the patients who you should consider for extended therapy, indefinite therapy, only stopping it when their risk of bleeding outweighs their risk of continuing. So in patients with first VTE that's unprovoked, proximal DVT or PE, if they have a low or moderate risk of bleeding, we suggest extended therapy. So this is what I was just mentioning there. So they are saying, based on the evidence, it's grade 2B evidence, that if you have a DVT of unclear etiology, you couldn't identify a risk factor, those patients probably need more than 3 months of therapy. They need indefinite therapy, again, until you have a reason to stop. If they have a high bleeding risk, so if you identify this patient, say, as a fall risk, or they need surgery, or they have a history of AVMs, then they're recommending 3 months of therapy as opposed to this indefinite extended therapy. And also, they mention in the recommendations to reassess annually. So if these patients need follow-up, a year later, 2 years later, you examine the risks and benefits of continuing. Have they had any symptoms? Do they have any ongoing risk factors? What's their risk of bleeding? And if the risks outweigh the benefits, then you can consider stopping at any point down the road. But they definitely need to be reassessed for these risks. So here is if we have a second unprovoked VTE who has a low bleeding risk, we recommended extended therapy. If they have a moderate bleeding risk, they recommend extended therapy. If they have a high bleeding risk, they suggest 3 months of therapy. So that's the same as the first unprovoked DVT, basically. So if you have a DVT with no risk factors, or you have a second episode of VTE in a patient, they're recommending, unless you have high bleeding risk, to treat indefinitely. In patients with DVT of the leg and active cancer and who do not have high bleeding risk, we recommend extended therapy over 3 months of therapy. If they have high risk, they recommend extended therapy over 3 months. So what they're saying is in patients with active cancer, the risk of recurrent VTE is so high, even if they have a relatively high bleeding risk, they have benefit of being treated on ongoing anticoagulation versus not. So I think this is an important finding and shows you just how significant cancer is in terms of VTE risk. So again, the evidence, grade 2B in this case, even if patients have what is deemed to be a relatively high bleeding risk, they're still recommending continuing anticoagulation unless you're forced to stop. So the just a little note that I put in here about the reason for extended therapy. If you go through the whole guideline and they break down all of the studies, the risk of recurrence is reduced while the patient remains on therapy of extended duration, but the risk returns to baseline once the therapy is discontinued, regardless of how long they were treated. So that is why they're recommending 3 months versus any longer set period of therapy. That while the patient is on anticoagulation, obviously their risk is going to be decreased. So if they're on therapy at 12 months, yes, their risk is going to be decreased more than if they got 3 months of therapy and then stopped. But the risk, regardless of how long, it always returns to baseline. So if I treat someone for 3 months and then stop, or for 24 months and then stop, their risk of getting a new DVT in the 25th month is going to be the same. So that's why they're not recommending anything longer than 3 months. It's only protective while they're on it. It doesn't give you any benefit over the long term. So that's why they break it down. You're either going to treat for 3 months or you're going to treat forever until you need to stop. So how about the use of aspirin? This is not aspirin for treatment. We know that aspirin is far inferior to these other anticoagulations. But what some of the trials have looked at is that if you have patients with a proximal DVT or PE, you treat them for their 3 months with a NOAC or vitamin K antagonist, and you're stopping the therapy, there is some evidence that it's reasonable to put that patient on aspirin then indefinitely. It does give some benefit of prophylaxis long-term. So I think to me, this was something new, not something that I typically practice. Once I treat a patient, I don't consider putting them on aspirin after that for ongoing therapy, but they are recommending you consider doing that. Again, they also do mention, though, aspirin is not an option in place of other therapy. And also, one thing I think was good that they mentioned is remember resuming aspirin if it was stopped when other anticoagulation was started. So if you have someone who comes in with a DVT, they're on aspirin because they had a TIA in the past, you put them on one of the NOACs, you may decide to stop the aspirin while they're on that NOAC. But if you're going to stop it down the road, it's important to go back and say, this patient was on aspirin for a previous TIA. Now that I'm stopping my 3 month anticoagulation, I'm going to put them back on aspirin. Yes?
What dose aspirin,
Ralph? They didn't put a dose in the trials. I think I'm trying to remember the summaries they had of the different trials they looked at. I think it was 325, but I don't think it was anything statistically significant. Okay, so now I just want to mention about the isolated distal DVT. This is something that I think there's often a lot of discussion about between physicians and on rounds when we identify someone who has maybe a small calf thrombus. We're not sure, how do we treat that? Does it need to be treated? So the recommendation is in patients with acute isolated distal DVT of the leg without severe symptoms or risk factors for extension, we suggest serial imaging of the deep veins for 2 weeks over anticoagulation. So if you have someone who does not have severe symptoms, maybe they had a little calf swelling, or maybe they had a fever and you did Doppler is looking for their source of fever, and you identify a small calf thrombus, recommendation is not to anticoagulate that patient. It's just to follow them for 2 weeks. Serial Dopplers, they don't say how often serial means. I've seen in some of the studies every 48 hours, every 72 hours. But basically, you just follow them clinically every few days, Dopplers. And if there's a progression or extension of that clot, then you anticoagulate. Otherwise, you can just follow them for 2 weeks. Excuse me. if the patient has risk factors for extension or severe symptoms, then they recommend you do initiate anticoagulation. So this is a clear case where you have to weigh the risks and benefits of bleeding. If we have someone who just is post-op and we find a little calf DVT and they had major abdominal surgery, we might be more inclined to observe them versus not. If they broke their leg and now they're going to be bedbound, we're more likely to treat that distal DVT than not. So you have to weigh the risks and the benefits of bleeding and the risks and the benefits of what is their ongoing risk of that clot progressing. So some of the extension, the risk factors for extension of that clot are the size, how many centimeters is it, how much of the calf vein is already filled by the time you diagnose it, do they have a cancer history, do they have a history of previous VTE, or are they an inpatient if they're hospitalized and continuing to be relatively immobile. So any of those extension risks, you're going to be more likely to treat than to observe. So in patients with acute isolated distal DVT of the leg who are managed with anticoagulation, we recommend using the same anticoagulation as for patients with proximal DVT. So basically what they're saying there is if you're going to treat for the recommended 3 months. You don't treat, if you're going to treat a calf DVT, you don't say it's only a calf DVT, so I'm going to treat for 6 weeks or 8 weeks. If you make the commitment to treat, you're going to do for 3 months. In patients with acute isolated DVT, distal DVT of the leg who are managed with serial imaging, we recommend no anticoagulation if the thrombus does not extend, suggest anticoagulation if the thrombus extends but remained in the distal vein, and recommend anticoagulation if it extends to the proximal vein. So what they're saying is if on your serial imaging, the clot stays the same or gets smaller, you keep observing. If it gets any bigger, even if it doesn't extend proximally, then you start anticoagulation. So catheter thrombolysis, this is one of the newer modalities that's available. So these are the first guidelines where they make some recommendations on that. So if we have patients with an acute proximal DVT of the leg, we suggest anticoagulant therapy alone over catheter-directed therapy. That's what CDT is. So they're not recommending catheter-directed therapy as your first-line option. If you're able to be anticoagulated without an excessive risk of bleeding, that should be your treatment of choice. Catheter-directed therapy may have benefit in reducing post-thrombotic syndrome, but may have increased cost and initial risk. So that's what's in their discussion of this recommendation. So there is an advantage to catheter-directed therapy, not in fixing or resolving the DVT. The anticoagulation does that just as well. But we have a problem, which hopefully people are familiar with, called post-thrombotic syndrome. So once someone has, even if you have an isolated lower extremity DVT that's properly treated and resolves and never recurs, people can have chronic issues from that, chronic venous stasis, leg edema, ulcers, chronic pain in that leg. So DVT, even after resolution, can have lifelong complications. So that's why they make this comment about catheter-directed therapy, is there is evidence that if you go in and actively remove that clot quicker than what anticoagulation would do, that you may be able to decrease some of those long-term complications. So again, the evidence is not strong enough to say that should be our treatment of choice, but again, in the right patient, you have that discussion. If you have a 25-year-old who has a DVT, I might be more inclined to consider that and try to avoid a lifelong problem for them versus a 90-year-old who has it that I can anticoagulate. Because there are some downsides to catheter-directed therapy. You have some risk of the procedure. It's more expensive than just giving the person a pill of one of the oral anticoagulants and sending them home. But again, you might have that benefit with post-thrombotic syndrome. How about IVC filters? This is one of my favorite topic because I see a lot of variation and a lot that I disagree with that I think is done in practice. Grade 1B evidence says in patients with acute DVT or PE who are treated with anticoagulants, we recommend against the use of an IVC filter. So I see all the time people say, well, this person has a big DVT, so I'm going to put a filter in, or they have a PE and still a DVT, so I'm going to put a filter in so they won't have throw another embolus that'll make them sicker. There's absolutely no evidence that putting an IVC filter in someone who you're going to anticoagulate is beneficial. In fact, IVC filter increases the incidence of DVT down the road. It does decrease the incidence of PE, so that is true. But despite that, there's no effect on mortality. So if you have an invasive device that's going to make you more likely to develop clot down the road, and it's not going to improve your mortality, there's absolutely no reason to do an IVC filter if that patient can be anticoagulated. Any questions about that? So don't do it. So IVC filters are really for only people that you can anticoagulate. If it's a temporary reason that you can't anticoagulate using a removable IVC filter, George, I'm sorry to take all your business away. You can use a temporary filter if someone, say, was in a car accident, bumped their head, they have a risk of extending their clot for a couple of months and a risk of bleeding for a couple of months. You can put a removable filter in, then George will bring them back in 3 months, take it out, and then they're done, and then their risk of recurrent DVT goes down, which I'm happy about. If they have an ongoing risk, they had a huge intracranial bleed, that's always going to be a risk of rebleeding, then you can put a permanent filter in. But if there's any way that you can anticoagulate them, there's no need for a filter. Okay, just this is a recommendation on post-thrombotic syndrome. This isn't compression stockings having to do with treating or preventing VTE itself. This is what's the role for compression stockings in trying to help with that entity of the post-thrombotic syndrome that I mentioned. And some people were arguing or proposing that if we put compression stockings on these people early on, that we can prevent post-thrombotic syndrome, and the answer is no, that they don't do that. So they suggest not using it routinely. That doesn't mean you shouldn't use compression stockings. It's just that the evidence says that it's not going to prevent post-thrombotic syndrome by using them early on. They do have a role in reducing symptoms. So if you have patients who have edema from post-thrombotic syndrome, the compression stockings can help with that. It's just not going to prevent the syndrome itself. How about subsegmental PE? I think this is another thing that often there's some controversy and discussion about. So if you have a patient with subsegmental PE, so the proximal pulmonary arteries are clear, they do not have a DVT. So you do a CT, you see they have one or two maybe small distal clots. You do an ultrasound, they don't have DVT in the legs. You think their risk for recurrent VTE is low. So say they just had surgery, but now they're going to be up ambulating and discharged from the hospital. They suggest clinical surveillance over anticoagulation. So to me, I think this is a big one. That should be 2C, not 20. So to me, this is, I think, a big thing that they put this down, because we'd always discuss, should we anticoagulate? Often we would anticoagulate. They're saying if the risk factor is waning and the patient is not having significant symptoms and they have a low risk for further VTE, that patient for a subsegmental small pulmonary embolism does not need long-term anticoagulation. If they have a high risk of VTE, say they're still hospitalized or they had a hip fracture and they're going to be sitting in rehab for a while, then they are suggesting anticoagulation. So when you're talking about small distal pulmonary embolism, the key of whether to anticoagulate or not depends on what is their ongoing risk. If it's low, you do not need to anticoagulate. If it's higher, you should anticoagulate. One of the things you can do is consider serial ultrasound. So if we know this patient has a small subsegmental clot and today they have no DVT, that's reassuring that they don't need anticoagulation. But one of the ways you can manage that is, say, until their risk factors really return to zero, twice a week or once a week, get an ultrasound. If they start to develop DVT, making you think now they're at risk for another PE, that's when you may elect to start anticoagulation. Surveillance is better with a high risk of bleeding or good cardiopulmonary reserve. So if you have a patient who's got already heart failure, low EF, bad COPD on oxygen, they can't tolerate a pulmonary embolism as well, those people you're more likely to anticoagulate. And then again, with cancer and low reserve and no risk factors, you're better off treating than not treating. How about out-of-hospital treatment of pulmonary embolism? In patients with low-risk PE and whose home circumstances are adequate, we suggest treatment at home or early discharge over standard discharge. When they say standard discharge, they mean kind of how we used to or should have been doing things in the past, where you have intravenous therapy or injected therapy for at least 5 days while you start a vitamin K antagonist and then discharge them at some point after that. So this to me is very important, and the evidence is very clear. A patient with a pulmonary embolism who's not hemodynamically unstable, who has good family support, can follow up with their primary doctor, does not even need to be admitted to the hospital. They can be discharged on one of the NOAC therapies and followed up as an outpatient. These are patients, again, who have good reserve. They don't have end-stage COPD and now pulmonary embolism. They have no bleeding risk. It's not like somebody who has a history of a recent intracranial hemorrhage and you want to observe them in the hospital and do neurochecks as you anticoagulate them, and patients who are compliant, who you know, trust, are going to take their NOAC therapy. But if you have the right person and the right pattern, there's absolutely no reason that you can't treat pulmonary embolism as an outpatient. How about thrombolysis for pulmonary embolism? So the guidelines too now are a little different than they were several years ago, where they had a number of indications for thrombolysis, hypotension, hypoxemia, right heart strain on echocardiogram. All of those except for hypotension now have been taken away. So they're recommending you treat with thrombolysis only if the patient is in shock. If they have right heart strain on echo, that's not an indication necessarily for thrombolysis. If they have hypoxemia, they're on non-rebreather mask, that's not a definite indication for thrombolysis. The only indication, absolute indication, is hypotension. And that, too, is if they don't have a high bleeding risk. If someone's risk of bleeding is too high, then you shouldn't thrombolyze them. So in most patients with acute PE not associated with hypotension, we recommend against thrombolytic therapy. So not only are they recommending it for hypotension, they're saying for some of those other indications that I mentioned, not to give it. The risk of bleeding outweighs the benefit. So in selected patients with acute PE who deteriorate after starting anticoagulant therapy but have yet to develop hypotension, we suggest systematically administered thrombolytic therapy over no therapy. So basically what they're trying to say here is these patients who are on the borderline need to be closely monitored, and if you see them heading towards hypotension, prepare to administer it. You don't have to wait till now you're on pressors before you do. So there's a fine line there over when to start, but basically they're recommending watch closely and be prepared to start it if hypotension is developing. High-risk patients need close monitoring to observe for worsening. Also, I found interesting in their discussion that echocardiogram to evaluate right ventricle is not universally indicated. So I was in the habit of getting echoes on everybody with pulmonary embolism. They're recommending in the guidelines, do not do that. Obviously, if you have any of these large PEs or unstable patients, absolutely it's indicated. But if you identify a single small, you know, subsegmental pulmonary embolism, that patient doesn't need an echocardiogram. There's no benefit to evaluating the RV, again, because the recommendations are we're not going to treat based on RV anymore, only on hemodynamic effects. How about catheter removal of pulmonary embolism? So in patients with acute PE who are treated with a thrombolytic agent, we suggest systemic thrombolytic versus catheter-directed therapy. So if you decide this patient needs thrombolysis, their risk of thrombolysis is acceptable, meaning their bleeding risk is low enough, the recommendation is to use systemic TPA over catheter-directed TPA. They do say you consider catheter-directed therapy if the patient has a high bleeding risk and if you have access to good catheter-directed therapy. So here, we're more likely to choose that over maybe an institution that doesn't have a good interventionalist who is proficient in catheter-directed therapy. But still, if the bleeding risk allows, systemic thrombolytics are the choice of treatment over catheter therapy at this point. So in patients with acute PE associated with hypotension who have a high bleeding risk, failed systemic thrombolysis, or have shock that is likely to cause death before systemic thrombolysis can take effect, and you have the resources, then consider catheter-directed therapy. So if you have someone who is hypotensive, is too high a bleeding risk to use systemic thrombolysis, number one, then catheter-directed therapy is the procedure of choice. Number two, say you gave them systemic TPA and they're still dying, you might follow that up with catheter-directed therapy if the interventionalist is willing to attempt it after they got systemic TPA. Or if they have refractory shock, again, you've already treated them either with anticoagulation or thrombolysis, they're still in shock, you may consider catheter-directed removal at that point. So there definitely is a role for catheter-directed therapy either in high-risk bleeding or in refractory symptoms, shock. Thromboendarterectomy, I'm just going to mention, this is really beyond our scope here because we don't have access to someone who is proficient in doing this, but there's an entity called CTEF, chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. This is something that develops longer term after having a significant pulmonary embolism or recurrent pulmonary emboli, and that leads to chronic pulmonary hypertension. They suggest that patient be considered to undergo surgical removal of this chronic changes of the pulmonary arteries. That's not something that's done locally here, but they do recommend looking out for that and referring to a center where that's done if you make that diagnosis of chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. Upper extremity DVT, patients with acute upper extremity DVT that involves the more proximal upper extremity veins, the axillary veins, or even proximal to that, we suggest anticoagulate therapy alone over thrombolysis. So again, the same as the lower extremities, anticoagulation is always your first choice over thrombolytic therapy. There was, I guess, some trials that were done in looking to see if catheter-directed therapy was beneficial to remove upper extremity clots. The answer, based on the evidence, is no, just anticoagulate them like you normally would. So if you have patients who do undergo thrombolysis, they're still recommending that you treat for the 3 months after that versus not treating. So a catheter-directed procedure does not mean that they don't need ongoing anticoagulation. They still need their 3 months of therapy. How about recurrent VTE on therapy? So this we run into. You have a patient who comes in on warfarin, and because they had a DVT in the past and now they have another DVT. How are we going to treat that patient? So in patients who have recurrent VT on VKA therapy in the therapeutic range, so that's number one, is was the patient really therapeutic or not? Or that's on one of the NOACs and are believed to be compliant. We suggest switching to treatment with low molecular weight heparin at least temporarily, and the recommended is at least 1 month, then reevaluate. So again, like the cancer patients, low molecular weight heparins do so some benefit over the oral anticoagulants in terms of their risk of recurrence. So if you have a patient who you think is a true recurrence on one of the oral agents, it does make sense to move them to a low molecular weight heparin to treat them. You have to consider whether it's a true recurrence. Was the patient really taking their drug properly? Were they really therapeutic? Or is this just the same DVT they had in the past that never resolved? You have to look at their compliance. Again, were they really taking their drug? And then consider underlying malignancy. So it's very, very rare to have recurrent, unprovoked VTEs on adequate anticoagulation. So you have to think of two things. Are they really doing it right, or do they have some underlying malignancy that's making them hypercoagulable? So that being said, you're looking for that. In the interim, the recommendation is you treat those patients with a low molecular weight heparin. In patients who have recurrent VTE that are already on a low molecular weight heparin, we suggest increasing the dose by 1/4 to 1/3. So if you have people on enoxaparin injections, they get a recurrence, you raise the dose against above the normal recommended dose of 1 mg/kg. That's it. Any questions? Yes. They don't specifically break down all the hereditary or hematologic risk, but basically for any of those, they're in the group of ongoing risk that need, I guess, essentially lifelong, what they call extended therapy. So those patients you should treat indefinitely unless their risk factor goes away, which for most of those it never does. So you can make an argument that even if they have, say, a lupus anticoagulant, but they got this current DVT because they were in the hospital for surgery, and now they're out, they're back to their normal risk, you can make an argument not to. And that is kind of what they say in the guidelines, is cases like that, you weigh the risks and benefits. If it's their second incidence, they've had two documented VTEs, and they have one of those risks, lupus anticoagulant, factor V, then they need lifelong therapy. That is true that they're not approved specifically for that, but in all, I guess, all of the studies that they looked at for these guidelines, they didn't identify any difference in efficacy between the NOACs or warfarin. So as far as the guidelines are concerned, you can use them all. In fact, in many instances, they prefer the NOACs to warfarin. So as far as they're concerned, the guidelines are the NOACs are fine even in those inherited thrombophilic conditions. You know, they don't have a specific recommendation. I think I look at that the same as the distal lower extremity, is that if you don't have a strong indication to, those don't need to be anticoagulated. Yeah, so the ECOS, they do mention, I guess, what they talked about the ECOS in the guidelines is that all of the trials for the ECOS are very, very small, like double-digit patients. So they say they did see some benefits in terms of the time to resolution and things like that, but not enough of a benefit where they would say that's the standard of care. So the standard of care is still just anticoagulation. But again, in patients who are higher risk of anticoagulation or who you want to achieve quicker resolution, then the catheter treatments like the ECOS definitely do that. Yeah, I think that's important because people don't recognize how significant post-thrombotic syndrome is a big problem. I still remember as a fellow, I had a 25-year-old patient who broke his leg and got DVT, and he was dealing with, at that young age, post-thrombotic syndrome that is going to be a lifelong problem. So if you have the opportunity to intervene and address that, I think it's important. There is not, and the recommendation is, ideally, if you're going to do it, you want to do it prior to starting regular anticoagulation, but again, what they mention here in the guidelines is even if you already start that and the patient decompensates, it can still be given at any point. You don't have to be in a certain time window.
So we don't need to know the onset.
Dr. Palumbo, we have a question from Delroy.
Correct. If they come in and are hypotensive, regardless of when the actual clot started, there's still benefit to giving the TPA.
Ralph, I think there's a call coming in from one of the other. Dr. Palumbo,
oh.
Can you hear us? From Delray?
How do I?
I have a question from
anybody?
For some reason, some orthopedic surgeons prefer the use of aspirin over NOACs. Do you know if the American College of Surgeons has adopted the CHEST guidelines?
Yeah, so I know the question is about the use of aspirin. And in this case, I think they're talking about prophylaxis where I only focused on treatment of VTE, but there is, and I think in the orthopedic surgery guidelines, they have aspirin listed as an acceptable prophylaxis for VTE. In the data, definitely it does prophylax better than nothing for VTE, but it's not equivalent to any of the other agents we use for prophylaxis, like prophylactic dose low molecular weight heparin, or any of the NOACs, or using warfarin for prophylaxis. So is aspirin a prophylactic? Does it reduce the incidence of VTE? It definitely does. But in the medical literature, it's not recommended because the others are so superior without a significant increase in complications. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the issue. Definitely in those cases, the risk is already low, and adding aspirin does give you a little further reduction in that risk. So it definitely is reasonable to do, but is it reasonable enough to take that chance when there's really not much downside to using one of the other agents? I'm not sure that it is. Yes. Yeah, so there's no nothing in the guidelines in terms of retrievable or not, although when you talk with a lot of the experts, that's what they recommend because, again, really there is a lot of downside to a filter for recurrent VTE. So they always recommend, if it's a limited risk of bleeding, to use a retrievable filter, and usually it should come out in 3 months. I think it has to come out within 6 months, or what you can tell me what your limit is. Yeah, I said 3 months because that should be your duration of treatment, and then you can stop. But another important thing, I think, is if you have someone who just had surgery, maybe their risk of bleeding is only for 1 month. So one option is you do the filter for a month, then remove it, and for the second 2 months, you anticoagulate them. All right, thank you.